Well, I want to present to you now the newest member of the federal judiciary in this state, a distinguished alumnus of the University of Florida, the Honorable George C. Young. Judge Young, will you take a bow, please? Still on time, John, aren't we? We are not encroaching on the other territory. Speaking of encroaching on other people's time, I appeared before my favorite justice of peace one time. When I practiced in Jacksonville, I was widely regarded as an expert in justice of the peace jurisprudence. And after I'd been talking some time, I apologized in these words. I said, please pardon me for trespassing on your time. He said, son, you've passed the point of trespassing on my time. You're encroaching on eternity now. I don't want to encroach on eternity anymore, but friends, I want to present you with the political reverence that I feel for all leaders of the Democratic Party. I want to present to you the chairman of the Florida Democratic Party, the Honorable James M. Milligan. Jimmy, take a bow there, will you, son? That's fine. This other good man, I feel an affection and a regard and a goodwill for him that almost embarrasses me, considering the fact that he's a Republican. But he's such a nice Republican, such a fine sort of a person, that I can't feel the animosity to him that my sense of law tells me that I just can't feel the animosity the Democrat ought to feel towards a Republican. I want to present to you the chairman of the Florida Republican Party, Honorable G. Harold Alexander. Harold, will you take a bow there, son? He was such a tolerant, compassionate man that he brought a fine cake to that historic, unforgettable inauguration that took place in Tallahassee at high noon on January 4, 1949. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to introduce to you now, sorry I can't wait for the applause, thank you for being willing to. I want to present to you the presidents of other colleges. This is not the only college. It's the greatest and most glorious and most ascendant. But the other colleges. Yes, the other colleges. They pattern themselves after this college. They emulate this college. They do well to do it. But education is contagious here in Florida. It's endemic and epidemic. I won't guarantee those words. I use words mostly for sound effects, not sense. But anyhow, I want to be... This is far more than we expected, friends. Thank you very much. But I say, let your feelings go here. Don't try to pent up your feelings. It'll develop, may develop a psychosis. That's right. We don't want to miss the press. I had such beautiful relations, such tender relations with the press when I was in Tallahassee. I just don't want to overlook them. Thank you, John. That was a good reminder, son. It's brought us closer together. We natives of Trenton, the capital of Gilchrist County, Lunchtown, that sacred city almost like Bethlehem, the capital of Calhoun County. We're still on time, and we are now. We're losing ground, aren't we? But let me get going here. I want to present to you the distinguished, scholarly, deep and profound and recondite president of the University of South Florida, Honorable John S. Allen. Dr. Allen, take a bow, will you? We had a few others scheduled, but they didn't show. Maybe they didn't want to be dazzled by the iridescent brilliance of this great institution here. I want to present to you now the superintendent of the Florida School for the Deaf and Blind. Over an hour away, they call that the DEEF. I want to present to you Dr. John Wallace. Dr. Wallace, will you take a bow? Oh, yes. We are honored to have, as the president of Southern College, a very fine educational institution, we are honored to have that president, Dr. Charles T. Thrift, Jr. Dr. Thrift, we're very glad to have you. The fellow who made out this schedule lacked some political sagacity. He didn't include the members of the Florida Railroad and Public Utilities Commission. And only by virtue of the authority which I am hereby vesting in myself, I'm going to introduce them. I might have some little controversial matter before them up there. I want to present to you all of the members of the Florida Railroad and Public Utilities Commission. Wilbur, will you and Jerry and that other good man get up, please? That's fine. All right. We're still on time, aren't we, John? Just barely. About 2 seconds behind. Just a few moments, friends. I'm going to recede into that silence that's so becoming to me and so much appreciated by those who have to hear me. But I have a most delightful privilege and honor now. I want to present to you probably the most distinguished alumnus of the University of Florida. Be presumptuous of me to recount his great achievements. I believe I speak what all of you know when I say he's closer to the President of the United States than any Florida statesman has ever been. I believe it's probably not wholly inaccurate to say that he is closer to President Kennedy than President Kennedy is to the Pope himself. I have the pleasure, my friends, I have the pleasure of presenting to you. I ain't quite ready to present him yet. I want to say this. Florida needs Kennedy and Johnson as president and vice president until 1969. But the Constitution will prevent. I want to say that Florida needs them, the nation needs them, the world needs them. But the Constitution won't let us have that same combination for the 4 years following. I believe one of the most irresistible and unconquerable and invincible combinations of the Democratic Party that would guarantee victory would be Lyndon B. Johnson at the head of the ticket and George Smathers of Florida next to him. I present George Smathers.
Governor Bryant, Dr. Reitz, President Jim, members of Blue Key and guests, I'm indeed very grateful to Governor Warren for three things. 30 years of warm and rewarding friendship. The very generous manner in which he has treated me this evening. And thirdly, for the fact that he didn't further use up any of my time. In the frontier days of this country's history, Texas gave leaders to the nation who became legendary. But none of these heroes of olden times stands taller or looms greater than the leaders Texas has given to the nation during the years that have marched up to today's new frontiers of challenge and crisis. Our speaker tonight is obviously a Texan born in near the little town of Stonewall, Texas. He graduated from Southwest State Teachers College of Texas. He taught in the Houston Public Schools. And finding himself drawn to the American political arena, came to Washington as a secretary to a congressman. He liked what he saw. And he was elected to the Congress in his own right in 1937. He served in the House of Representatives for some 12 years and then was elected to the United States Senate in 1948. His career since 1937 is one of unparalleled service to his state and to his nation. Let me briefly tell you why I think we all owe so much to this Texan. In the 1950s, at a time of divided government, of split responsibility between the White House and the legislative branch of the government, it was this Texan who made democracy work. Without him and without his fellow Texan, Sam Rayburn, without their combined skills and their talents, democracy would have ceased to function. Lyndon Johnson's role during those critical years was to bring intelligent and independent men from all the states together for a cooperative action in the interest of all of the United States. These men had divergent views and conflicting convictions on all the national issues of the day. But through the persuasive skill and power of this man, through the leadership of Lyndon Johnson, they were willing to submerge their local and their special interest to the greater interest of our nation. And it was he who led us as a nation to greater and newer goals of accomplishment and achievement. This record was made at a time when his party had a majority in the Congress of the, in the Senate of the United States of only one. And most of the time, as a matter of fact, that majority was a minority. Obviously, his success, therefore, was based on his personality, his consummate persuasiveness, his perception, his patience, and above all, his incomparable courage. It was his accomplishments during those years of divided responsibility which earned for him that deserved superlative, the greatest majority leader in the history of the United States Senate. In 1960, Lyndon Johnson gave up the leadership of the Senate to bring his power of persuasiveness to win votes that meant victory for his party in the national election. This year, following his inauguration as the Vice President of the United States, he has already been called upon to practice his persuasiveness and his skill on a vaster stage, the world. From the awesome crisis that we now see in Berlin to the frustrations of an India, he has represented the United States superbly, and the nation is the stronger for it, and the nation is the greater in his debt for it. It has been my privilege as a congressman and as a senator to work closely with him and to observe him at first hand and the remarkable talents that he possesses. Texas indeed is a land of superlatives. They always talk, and they descriptively talk about the biggest and the bravest and the tallest. But in my humble judgment, the most superlative quality of Texas has been the caliber and the quality of the men. And none of them has surpassed in contributions to these United States that contribution made by Lyndon Johnson. As one ever grateful for his personal interest and his political guidance, I am indeed proud to have this opportunity to now present to you, as your speaker this evening, this man who stands tall and fine in any group, in any company, anywhere throughout the world, the Vice President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson of Texas.
Dr. Reitz, Senators Holland and Smathers, and members of the Florida delegation, my fellow candidates, Americans all, I did not come here for profit or payment or even pleasure. I came here because I wanted to be in the midst of friends, and because I wanted to say to the graduates of this great institution how deeply I feel in their debt and how grateful all the nation is for the fine and constructive statesmen they have sent in the form of their Democratic delegation to the Congress. remember it was 20 years ago when I was attempting to go to the Senate in Texas that Claude Pepper left the Senate to come to Texas to try to help me. And I shall never forget that. I remember it was just a few days ago when Billy Matthews, who represents this district, came and sat at my desk, and together we joined in an effort to help our country. I remember what a former vice president from Texas said one time when they asked him why he thought Texas had the best delegation in the Congress. And I am reminded of that statement when I see your delegation, the graduates of this university who are here today, Congressman Matthews and Bennett, and Paul Rogers and Jim Haley. John Garner said the reason I think we have the best delegation in the Congress is because we pick them young and we pick them honest. We send them there and we keep them there. I left my father's room one day when he was in his last days in a prominent Texas hospital. And he said, "Son, get me my britches. I'm going home." And I said, "Daddy, we don't have a hospital in Johnson City. We don't have oxygen tents. We don't have the nursing facilities. Why in the world do you want to go home?" He said, "I want to go home where they know when you're sick and they care when you die." Well, I'm not sick, and I'm not planning to die anytime soon. But if I were entertaining thoughts in either direction, I would like to be in the presence of the people who are here tonight, particularly my colleagues in the Senate. That's sound and courteous, that's stable and ingenious, that imaginative, tenacious, determined statesman who always speaks his mind to presidents and freshmen, who always stands up for what he thinks is right without fear or favor, my good friend, the senior senator from this state, Spencer Hollis. I want to thank Governor Warren for his graciousness and the excellent manner in which he has presided over this meeting. I learned a long time ago never to make a speech at a football game or a country dance or attempt to compete with a man who is really humorous. But I will say, Governor, that in my judgment, you have made the second best Toastmaster that I ever heard. When I first went to Congress in 37, I came back to my little town of 600. They gave a chicken supper in the schoolhouse. And the county judge was head of the committee and supposed to preside. He got sick at the last minute and didn't come, and I was forced to be Toastmaster myself. A great man left Georgia, not to come to Florida, but to come to Texas. And he became the president of the Republic of Texas and the author of one of the best statements that I have ever read. And I think it's appropriate to remind those of you who make up the Blue Key Society of what President Lamar, that great Georgian, said in connection with the founding of what we hope would be a university of the first class. He said, "An educated mind is the guardian genius of democracy. It is the only dictator that free men recognize, and the only ruler that free men desire." So I was very proud to hear your extremely well qualified and vigorous and able governor talk to you on one of the most important subjects of our time, the educated mind. And I know that he and you will be proud of every bit of talent and effort and money that you put into the educated minds of this state. Florida is not just represented by a fine congressional delegation, by two able senators. The best and most effective ambassadors it really has is two girls named Mary, one named Mary Holland and one named Rosemary Smathers. I had lunch with the president today, and he met with 25 Texas editors, and he discussed with them freely and frankly some of the decisions that face him and some of the problems that confront him. And living as we do in a land where the people are free and going to remain free, the president has some problems that dictators don't have. I remember a Russian admiral that advocated long-range submarines. And the ruling powers did not agree, and he didn't remain admiral very long, and he's not here with us today. I remember a Russian leader who advocated a 5-year plan, only to be ostracized. And the fact that they adopted a 5-year plan 2 years later didn't ever bring him back public favor. A good many people who express themselves freely in that country wind up by going to Siberia. Well, I want to talk to you about the problem we have in this kind of a world in which we live today, which we constitute 190 million people in a world of 3 billion. I'll try to stay within my time limitation. If I have any left over, I will do what the little hill country boy did one day when he left the cotton patch in my country and didn't show up from noon until dark, and the boss was weighing in and said, "Where in the world have you been, Sammy, all afternoon?" He said, "I was over at the old Confederate reunion." Well, said, "What were you doing?" Said, "I was listening to United States Senator Joseph Weldon Bailey speak." Well, he said, "Senator Bailey didn't speak all afternoon, did he?" Said, mighty near. Well, he said, "What did Senator Bailey say?" The little boy scratched his hair and trembling and fearful looked up in the boss's eyes and said, "Well, boss, I don't recollect precisely what the senator had to say, but my general impression was he recommended himself most highly." A few days ago, I said goodbye to a distant from a faraway land. He was not a distinguished person by the standards of those who must govern their lives by the requirements of protocol. His home is a cage-like frame made of reeds and plastered over with mud. He has no electricity, no plumbing, no running water, except that which flows through the gutters of Karachi after a rainstorm. And they have about a dozen inches rainfall per year. He has fathered 11 children, and 7 are dead, because medical knowledge, which is commonplace among our high school science students in America, has never been made available to him. His assets up to the time of his visit to America were very limited. In addition to his children, they included his wife, a camel, a cart upon which he still owes some money, a quick, warm smile, and a simple, natural, inbred sense of courtesy and good manners and dignity. He earned from $3 to $5 a day hauling wheat and straw and furniture or anything else that would fit a camel cart. Half of his earnings every day went back into the camel. The balance disappeared rapidly in feeding and clothing his family and paying off the debt on his cart. Nothing was set aside for recreation in the budget of Bashir Ahmed and his family. Bashir worked from dawn to dusk 6 days a week, and his seventh day was and still remains devoted to God. When business was slack and he had a few spare hours, they were spent listening to broadcasts over community loudspeakers or to the few educated men of his neighborhood who know how to read. 85% of the 95 million cannot read or write. This is not an unusual life story. It could be duplicated hundreds of millions of times. Bashir Ahmed represents the great mass of humanity, which has been shunted into the stagnant backwaters of the 20th century by the violent riptides and the shifting currents of history. When the Soviet Union recklessly strews radioactive poison in the atmosphere, it seeks to frighten the Bashirs of this world. When the Soviet generals rattle ICBMs in menace, they seek to cow into submission the Bashirs of this world. When the Viet Cong assassins lurk at night in the shadows of Saigon, they seek to terrorize the Bashirs of this world. But if my camel-driving friend with whom I spent last week is a yardstick, let's say to them that he does not terrorize easily. The communists have abandoned even the pretense of winning an effort to win the minds and hearts of men by holding forth to them the promise of a better life. Openly and without apology, communism has dedicated itself to the rule of fear and force. Since the beginning of the Cold War, there's been little doubt of Soviet objective or Soviet goals. The Iron Curtain descended in Europe and the Bamboo Curtain in Asia. The communists paid only lip service to the deep yearning of humanity for freedom and for progress and for peace. And now, the communists do not even give those goals in passing nod of recognition. By building a wall of concrete and barbed wire through Berlin, they admitted that people can be kept under communism only by walls and fences and straitjackets. By launching their atomic tests in the atmosphere, they admitted that they had no respect for humanity or its opinions. And by trying to wreck the United Nations Secretariat, they admitted that they do not want an organization to try to maintain the peace. I repeat, these actions do not reveal anything new about the communist aims and goals, nothing that we did not know before. But the brazenness with which they have ripped away the thin veil of hypocrisy makes it apparent that they are determined to bring some matters to a head. How many and to what extent? We do not know. At the very least, the communists are determined to test America's strength and fortitude as we have never been tested before. And as prudent men, it is incumbent upon us to survey the situation and to make certain that our defenses are sound. We must also determine the wisest policies to follow in a situation which is in some respects new. Any survey, any evaluation must proceed against the background of one clear certainty. It is that the free world possesses overwhelming strength. We have the manpower. We have the weapons. We have the resources. We have the industrial capacity. Of that, all of you may be sure. The wildest of communist propaganda cannot obscure this reality. This is not boasting, and it is not any effort to have you ever discount the strength of the Soviet Union. The communist world has proved its fighting ability. It has proved its ruthlessness and its power. We are not children who cherish the illusion that if we shut our eyes and wish upon the stars, the forces of evil will go away. But however great their strength, the Soviets could not ward off the retribution which the free world would inflict should the communists start a major war. And the whole history of the world since the end of World War II has made it clear that the communists cannot compete with us in economic production or purchasing power. The communist leaders are ruthless and reckless and misguided, but they're not fools. They do not practice atomic brinkmanship because they think they're too weak to resist. They're taking one of the biggest gambles in history, that America will not use her strength. And this gamble could well go down in history as the greatest miscalculation ever made.